staring out of those silver eyes was not a spirit or a being or a personality. It was a force of freaking nature, impersonal, implacable, and utterly beyond any control that I could exert. Prickles of sweat popped out on my forehead, and I broke the gaze, quickly looking down. A dark, cool hand touched my cheek, something of both benediction and gentle rebuke contained within it. "If this is Anthony's time," she said quietly, "I will see him safely to the next world. The Prince of Darkness himself will not wrest him from me." Her fingertips moved to my chin and lifted my face to look at her again. She gave me a small smile as she lowered her hand. "Neither will you, Harry Blackstone Copperfield Dresden, noble though your intentions may be." I didn't look away from her. The angel knew my name, down to the last inflection. Holy crap. Any fight against her would be very, very brief, and I was glad I hadn't simply allowed my instincts to take over. "Okay, then," I said a little weakly. "If you aren't here to kill him, why don't you help him? He's a part of your organization."
"As I have already told you, it is not given me to choose when a life will end or not end."
"Why not? I mean, why the hell not? Hasn't Fort Hill earned a break from you people?"
"It isn't a question of what he deserves," the angel said quietly. "It is a question of choice."
"So choose to help him. It isn't hard."
Her face hadn't shifted from its serene expression for more than a few seconds during the entirety of the conversation, but now it did change. It went flat and hard. Her silver eyes blazed. "Not for a mortal, no. Not hard at all. But such a thing is beyond me." I took a slow breath, thinking. Then I said, "Free will."
She inclined her head in a micro-nod, her eyes still all but openly hostile.
"Something given to you, yet denied to me. I may not take any action that abrogates the choices of a mortal."
"Fort Hill chose to die? Is that what you're saying?"
"Nothing so linear," she said. "This singularity is an amalgamation of many, many choices. Fitz chose to place what little precious trust he had in you. You chose to involve Anthony in the young man's existence. Anthony chose to come here, despite the danger. Aristides chose to assault him. Waldo and Daniel chose to involve themselves in his rescue. Beyond that, every single one of the people known to each individual I have mentioned have made choices that impacted the life of those involved. Together, all of you have determined this reality." She spread her hands. "Who am I to unmake such a thing?"
"Fine," I said. "Be that way."
"I will," the angel responded serenely.
I took one more look at Fort Hill and vanished, heading back toward Butters and Company. If the angel wasn't going to help the good father, I'd damn well do it myself. It was only a couple of jumps back to the far end of the factory floor, and it took me only a few seconds to get there.
"Fitz," I said, "I found the father. He's..."
"That seems reasonable," Aristides was saying to Butters. "May I ask one question?"
"Why not?" Butters answered. Fitz was squirming in Daniel's grip, leaning away from Aristides. One look at his face told me why. He'd recognized something in his old teacher's words or manner. I'd seen the faces of abused wives while they watched their husbands drink, sickly certain that the cycle of abuse would renew itself in the coming hours. Fitz knew what Aristides looked like when he was about to dispense violence.
"Wardens," Aristides said, "why do you not carry swords?"
Crap. The question caught Butters off guard. He could have smoothed over the question with a good answer, or maybe even ignored it altogether, convincingly, but he did the one thing he absolutely could not do if he was going to sell his false identity to Aristides. He hesitated. Couldn't blame him, I guess. He'd come lickety-split after Fort Hill, moving as fast as possible. We'd spent all of maybe 90 seconds on putting our plan together, which had only been possible thanks to Butters's foresight in packing those cloaks. Apparently, he'd thought it might be useful to have them on hand, to create a warden sighting or two, if it seemed like the city's supernatural scene could use some reassurance. In our hurry to retrieve the good father, I hadn't thought about the whole sword angle, for good reason. The hell of it was that Aristides was reaching an accurate conclusion based on an erroneous assumption. The swords of the wardens were fairly famous in supernatural circles. Bright silver, supernaturally sharp blades, perfect for chopping off the heads of warlocks, and wrought with spells to deflect or disrupt magical attacks or enchantments. When you saw wardens, you saw their swords. Or, at least, that had been the status quo until recently. The enchantress who had made them, Warden Lucio, had lost her capacity to create them when Corpse Taker had swapped her into the body of a young woman with very little natural inclination toward magic. As a result, most of the new wardens, starting with me, didn't have a groovy sword. Which meant that most of the wardens didn't carry swords any longer. But that impression apparently hadn't trickled down to street level yet. Things started happening very quickly. Aristides produced his knife, a wicked-looking number with a lot of extraneous points on it, an interpretation of a Bowie knife as done by H.R. Geiger. Daniel Carpenter had evidently noticed Fitz's behavior and deduced its meaning. He dragged both Fitz and Butters behind him with a sweep of his brawny arms and positioned himself between them and the sorcerer, his hands up in a defensive martial arts stance. Butters let out a yelp as his ass hit the cold concrete floor. Fitz took the fall and rolled, his eyes wide with terror as he regained his feet and started to run.
"You are all dead men," Aristides snarled.
And then he blurred forward, almost too quickly to be seen, the knife gleaming in his hand. Chapter 38 Aristides was nothing more than a streak in the air as he closed on Daniel, slamming into him, knocking him back. As Daniel fell, that wicked knife gleamed and whipsawed back and forth half a dozen times in the space of a second, striking Daniel in the chest and belly on every blow. Anyone other than Michael and Charity Carpenter's son would have been gutted like a fish. The kid had gotten some serious training, maybe from Murphy, maybe from the Einherjarin, maybe from his father. Probably from all of them. I'm not a professional when it comes to hand-to-hand combat, of the supernatural variety or otherwise, but I know enough to know how little I know. And one of the things I know is that you don't just decide to time your moves a second in advance to compensate for a lack of supernatural speed. You have to learn that stuff, to build it into your reflexes with weeks or months of painstaking practice. Daniel had. He started rolling with the slashes of the knife before Aristides had fully closed the distance, even as he stumbled backward from the force of the sorcerer's initial impact. The knife bit into his chest and belly, and found armor waiting for it. Beneath his winter coat, Daniel was wearing a garment I recognized as Charity's handiwork, a double-thick Kevlar vest with a coat of thick titanium rings sandwiched in between the layers of ballistic cloth. Kevlar could stop bullets, but it couldn't do squat for blades. That was what the titanium mail was for. Sparks flew up in rapid succession as the knife struck armor. The impact sounded like someone hitting a side of beef with a baseball bat, but Daniel's body was in motion, giving in with each of the blows, robbing them of the most savage portion of their power. The knife never touched his skin. Aristides came to a stop after that blinding fast combination of attacks and crouched, his arm out to one side, parallel to the ground, the knife gripped hard in it. He looked like an extra in a martial arts movie, the goober. Daniel turned his backward momentum into a roll and came up on his feet. It didn't look very graceful, but he was obviously in control of the motion, and he dropped into a fighting crouch about 20 feet from the sorcerer. One hand went into his hip pocket and came out with a simple folding lock knife with a black plastic handle. With his thumb, he snapped out a blade maybe 4 inches long and held the weapon tucked in close to his body, point toward Aristides. He jerked the cloak off his back and, with a few flicks of his arm, wrapped the heavy material around his left forearm. Then he held his left hand a little in front of him, palm down, fingers loose, ready to block or grab. Aristides had a good poker face, but for the moment I didn't have anything to do except watch what was going on, and I knew his type. The sorcerer hadn't been psychologically prepared for Daniel's reaction. The stupid bruiser was supposed to be bleeding on the floor, maybe begging for his life. At the very least, he should have been running, terrified. But instead, the very large young man had apparently shrugged off the deadly attacks and meant to fight.
"Nice knife," Daniel said. Scorn dripped from the words. "Get it out of a magazine?"
"From the last fool who tried a blade against me."
Daniel bared his teeth.
"Come here. I'll give you this one."
Aristides flicked his knife through a little series of spins, making it dance nimbly through his fingers. It was a stupid thing to do in a real situation, but the guy clearly knew how to use the weapon. Then his body tightened, and he hissed a word, and once more he flashed toward Daniel. The body language, before the spell that granted him speed, had given him away. The kid was ready again. He sidestepped and swept his arms in a pair of half-circles as Aristides flashed by. There was the sound of shearing cloth, and then the sorcerer was past him. Daniel turned to face Aristides with a hiss of pain. His left arm, wrapped in the gray cloak, was bleeding, red spreading through the gray in a slow but growing stain.
"No armor there," Aristides murmured with a smile.
Daniel said nothing. He just took position again, holding his bloodied knife level, its point toward the sorcerer. Aristides looked down and saw the long, shallow cut across his right pectoral. A fine sheet of blood had mixed with the sweat that had broken out on his skin. Heads were popping out of the debris and refuse now. Zero and his compatriots, maybe a dozen kids all told, were emerging from their hiding spots to watch the fight. From the looks on their faces, it was the first time they'd ever seen their fearless leader get hurt. Hell, if they'd been anything like me when I was young, they probably had believed that he couldn't be hurt. Daniel Carpenter had just shown them differently, and the sorcerer knew it. Aristides' face set into a grimace of undiluted hate as he stared at Daniel. Then he did something unexpected. He simply walked forward and pounced into knife range. The exchange was brief. Most knife fights are. Daniel, the taller of the two, had the advantage of reach, somewhat negated by the length of the sorcerer's blade. He wore armor over his torso and was stronger, but Aristides was the faster of the two, even without magic, and he had a lot more experience. Hands and knives flashed, all whip-crack speed and whispering violence as they parted the air. I couldn't keep track of the individual cuts. There were just too many of them. I saw Daniel's mail shirt turn aside another pair of strikes, one of them hard enough to send a titanium ring tinkling across the floor. A flicker of red fanned through the air where one of the fighters lost a splash of blood. Daniel let out a short grunt, then another. Aristides barked out a sound of both pain and satisfaction. The two parted, both breathing heavily. Combat taxes a body's reserves like nothing else on earth. Seconds of it can leave you exhausted, even if you're in great shape. Daniel staggered and went down on one knee, letting out a grunt of surprise. There were wounds on both of his legs, punctures, deep stabs. Neither wound had hit one of the big arteries, or he'd already be unconscious, but they were right through the quadriceps muscles and had to have been agonizing. He snarled and attempted to rise. Halfway there, he faltered and went down again. Training, courage, and fortitude get you only so far. A deep enough wound on either leg could have taken Daniel out of the fight. He had them on both. Aristides hadn't come away clean from the exchange, though. There was a deep cut on his right arm, where Daniel's knife had caught him hard. Flesh hung from a flap of skin. Blood flowed, but his arm still seemed to work. If Aristides lived long enough, and if he kept the arm, he was going to have one hell of a scar to show off later. But that wasn't going to matter much to Daniel. The sorcerer switched his knife to his left hand and stared at Daniel with flat eyes.
Kids like you haven't learned the price of doing business, when to trade pain for victory.
He blurred into motion again, and Daniel lifted his knife. Then the younger man cried out and fell to his side, clutching at his right arm with his left hand. His knife landed on the floor and spun away from him, eventually coming to rest against Aristides' feet. The sorcerer took his time, transferring his own knife to his left hand and picking up Daniel's. He tested the blade's balance and edge and said,
"Serviceable."
He carefully wiped the blood from Daniel's blade against the leg of his trousers, closed it, and slipped it into the pocket of his bathrobe. Then he fixed the young man with a nasty smile, raised his own blade over his head so that Daniel's blood dripped down it and fell on his upraised arm. And he started to chant. I felt the magic gathering at once. It wasn't particularly powerful, but that was by my own standards. Magic doesn't absolutely require a ton of horsepower to be dangerous. It took Aristides maybe 10 seconds to summon enough will and focus for whatever he was doing, and I stood there clenching my fists and my jaw in impotent fury. Daniel saw what was happening and found an old can in the detritus on the floor beside him. He threw it at Aristides in an awkward left-handed motion, but came nowhere close to striking the sorcerer. Aristides pointed the knife at Daniel, his eyes reptilian, hissed a word, and released the spell. Michael's eldest son arched his back and let out a strangled scream of agony. Aristides repeated the word, and Daniel contorted in pain again, his back bowing more than I would have thought possible. I stifled a furious scream of my own, and looked away as the sorcerer bent and twisted the energy of creation itself into a means of torment. Looking away was almost worse. Aristides' young followers were watching with a sick fascination. Daniel screamed until he was out of breath, and then began to strangle himself as he tried to keep it up. One of the kids bent suddenly and began retching onto the floor.
"This is my house," Aristides said, his expression never changing. "I am the master here, and my will is—"
Butters appeared behind Aristides from around an upended vat of some kind and swung 3 feet of lead pipe into the side of the sorcerer's knee. There was a sharp, clear crack as bone and cartilage snapped, and Aristides screamed and went down.
"That sound you just heard,"
Butters said, his voice tight with fear and adrenaline,
"was your lateral collateral ligament and anterior cruciate ligament tearing free of the joint. It's also possible that your patella or tibia was fractured."
Aristides just lay there in pain, gasping through clenched teeth. A line of spittle drooled out of his mouth. Butters hefted the lead pipe like a batter at the plate.
"Get rid of the knife, or I start on your cranium."
Aristides kept on gasping, but didn't look up. He tossed the creepy knife away.
"The one in your pocket, too," Butters said.
The sorcerer gave him a look of pure hatred. Then he tossed away the knife he'd appropriated from Daniel.
"Sit tight, Daniel,"
Butters called. "I'll be with you in just a second."
"Fine,"
Daniel groaned from the ground. He didn't sound fine. But as I watched, I saw him winding pieces of the slashed cloak around the wound in his right arm, binding them closed and slowing the bleeding. Tough kid, and thinking under pressure. Butters focused on Aristides.
"I don't want to hurt you," he said. "I want to help you. Your knee has been destroyed. You will never walk again if you don't get medical attention. I'll take you to a hospital."
"What do you want?"
Aristides growled.
"The priest, Fitz, these kids."
He bounced the lead pipe against his own shoulder a couple of times.
"And this really isn't a negotiation."
"Yes,"
I said, clenching my fist.
"You go, Butters."
Aristides eyed Butters for a moment more. Then he sagged and let out a soft groan of pain. Oh, crap.
You win,
the sorcerer said.
Just, please, help me.
Straighten it out, Butters said, never quite looking at the man. Lie back and leave it straight. Aristides fumbled with his leg and let out another higher-pitched moan of pain. Butters flinched at the sound, and his eyes were tortured. In a sudden flash of insight, I realized why he cut up corpses for a living instead of treating live patients. Butters couldn't handle seeing people in pain. That was what he'd always meant when he said that he wasn't a real doctor, when he said that treating living patients was messy and disturbing compared to extracting individual organs and cataloging them in autopsies. Dead people were just a pile of meat and bones. They were beyond all suffering. A physician needs a certain level of professional detachment if he is going to best serve his patients, and Butters just didn't have it. The little guy couldn't bring himself not to feel something for the people he worked with, so he had sought a career where he practiced medicine without trying to heal anyone, without involving himself with actual patients. Aristides had seen it too. He probably didn't understand it, but he saw the soft spot, and he went for it ruthlessly.
Don't, I breathed. Butters, don't!
Damn it, Butters said finally, gritting his teeth. He bent to help the man.
Hold still. You're just making it worse. Here.
He tried to keep a wary distance as he lent the man the hand, but it just wasn't possible to help him and stay out of reach. I saw it on his face as he realized it and began to withdraw. Then, as the man continued his low moans of pain, Butters gave his head a little shake and moved to help Aristides straighten his leg. I saw the sorcerer's eyes narrow to slits, an almost sensual pleasure contained in them.
Damn it, I said. Butters, move!
I vanished and appeared beside Butters, shoving my hands into his chest, willing myself to push him away. I didn't move him. My hands just passed into him, insubstantial. But a sudden frisson seemed to run through him, and he began to pull away. Too late. Aristides' left arm blurred and struck Butters squarely on the chin. If he hadn't been drawing back, the blow would have caught him just under the ear, and the sorcerer's hand was moving fast enough that it might have broken Butters' neck. Even so, the sharp thump of impact snapped Butters' head to one side, hard enough to rebound when it had reached maximum torsion. He did a brief bobblehead impersonation on the way to the floor and landed in a boneless heap. I wanted to scream in frustration. Instead, I poked at my brain, demanding it to come up with something. To my considerable surprise, it did. I vanished straight up to the ceiling and spun in a quick circle. There, I spotted Fitz moving in a low crawl toward one of the exits from the factory floor, keeping a modest pile of junk between himself and Aristides.
Fitz!
I bellowed. I vanished and reappeared right over him.
Fitz, you've got to turn around!
Quiet! He hissed in a frantic whisper. His eyes were white around the edges.
Quiet! No, I can't! Leave me alone! You've got to do it, I said. Fort Hill's here in the camp, hurt bad. There's a freaking angel of death standing over him. He needs help.
Fitz didn't answer me. He kept on crawling off the factory floor and into one of the hallways outside it. He was making desperate, small sounds as he reached the door and got out of any possible line of sight to Aristides.
Fitz, I said. Fitz, you have got to do something. You're the only one who can. Cops, he panted. I'll call the cops. They can handle it.
He got up and started padding down the hall toward what I presumed was the nearest exit from the building.
Butters and Daniel don't have that kind of time, I answered. The cops get tipped off by a runaway. We'll be lucky if a prowl car cruises by half an hour from now. All three of them could be dead by then. Your boss can't allow witnesses.
You're the wizard, Fitz said. Why can't you do it? I mean, ghosts can possess people and stuff, right? Just zap into Aristides and make him jump off the roof.
I was quiet for a moment. Then I said, Look, I'm new at this ghost thing, but it doesn't work like that.
Even the badass ghost of a centuries-old wizard I know of can only possess a subject who is willing. So far, I've only been able to move into people who were sensitive to spirits, and they could have booted me out any time they wanted. Aristides is neither sensitive nor willing. I'd be like a bug splattering on a windshield if I tried to take him over.
Christ!
If you want to volunteer, I could take you over, I suppose. I don't think you've got the right wiring for me to use my power, and you'd still be in danger, of course, but you wouldn't have to make the decisions. Fitz shuddered.
No.
Good. It's weird as hell. I paused and took a breath. And besides, it would be wrong.
Wrong?
Fitz asked. Take away someone's will, you take away everything they are, their whole identity. Doing that to someone is worse than murder. If you kill them, they don't keep on suffering.
Who cares? Fitz said. This guy's an animal. Who cares if he gets something bad? He's earned it.
Wrong is wrong, even when you really, really want it not to be, I said quietly. I learned that one the hard way. It's easy to do the right thing when it doesn't cost you. Not as easy to do the right thing when your back is to the wall. Fitz shook his head the whole time I spoke that last, and his pace quickened.
There's nothing I can do. I'm running for my life.
I fought down a snarl to keep my voice level. Time to change tactics. Kid, you aren't thinking it through, I said. You know Aristides. You know him.
Which part of running for my life didn't come across?
I grunted. The part where you leave your friends to die.
What?
He's busted up pretty bad right now. Weak. How long do you think it will take him to replace all your crew? Fitz's steps dragged to a stop. They've seen him weak now. Hell, he's hurt bad enough that he might be crippled for life. What do you think he'll do with the kids who saw him beaten, who saw him get bloodied and smashed to the floor? Fitz bowed his head.
Stars and stones, kid.
You start showing signs of independent thought, and he was so threatened by it that he set you up to get killed. What do you think he'll do to Zero? Fitz didn't answer.
You run now, I said quietly, and you're going to spend your whole life running. This is a crossroads. This is where your life takes form, here, now, this moment.
His face twisted up as if he was in physical pain. Still, he didn't respond. I wanted to put my hand on his shoulder, to give him the reassurance of a human touch. The best I could do was to soften my voice as much as I could.
I know what I'm talking about, kid. Every time you're alone in the dark, every time you go by a mirror, you're going to remember this moment. You're going to see who you've become. And you'll either be the man who ran away while his own crew and three good men died, or you'll be the man who stood tall and did something about it.
Fitz swallowed and whispered,
He's too strong.
Not right now, he isn't, I said. He's on the ground. He can't walk. He's got one arm. If I didn't think you had a chance, I'd be telling you to run.
I can't, he whispered. I can't. This isn't fair.
Life hardly ever is, I said.
I don't want to die.
No one does, but everyone does it anyway.
That's supposed to be funny.
Maybe a little ironic, given the source. Look, kid, all that matters is the answer to the question, which of those men do you want to be? Slowly he lifted his head. I realized that he could see his own reflection in the glass of an office door. I stood behind him, looking down at him and remembering, with a faint sense of irrational disbelief, that I had once been no taller than the boy. Which man, Fitz? I asked quietly.
Chapter 39. When I faced my old master, I did it with newly made staff and blasting rod in hand, with the ancient forces of the universe at my call, and with words of power upon my tongue. Fitz had more courage than I had as a child. He went to face his demons with no weapon at all. As his footsteps rapped steadily on the concrete floor, I was worried about the kid. He was doing this on my say-so. What if Aristides wasn't hurt as badly as I thought? What if he knew some kind of restorative magic? Fitz wouldn't have a chance, and I would never forgive myself.
I gritted my teeth and told myself not to borrow trouble. Things were bad enough without adding in a bunch of my own worries. That wouldn't help anybody. Fitz stepped into sight of Aristides and stopped in his tracks.
Easy, I said quietly. Calm. Don't show him any weakness. You can do it. Fitz took a deep breath and walked forward.
Fitz!
Aristides spat. He was sitting up now, his legs straight out in front of him. Butters' unconscious body had been dumped next to Daniel, who sat on the ground in a small puddle of his own blood, grimacing in pain and obviously disoriented. He'd bound the wounds closed, more or less, but it was clear that he still needed real medical attention. Zero and the other kids, several obviously detailed to watch Daniel and Butters, were standing around with pipes and old knives.
What do you think you're doing here, traitor?
Fitz faced him in silence.
You led those men to us. You've endangered the lives of everyone here.
Fitz almost seemed to dwindle, as if a cloud had passed between him and the wan light spilling in the windows. Dark, hostile eyes glared at Fitz from all around. A quick check with my senses confirmed that the sorcerer was using power.
He's pushing them, I said quietly, making them feel hostility toward you. It isn't real. You've got to shake him, break his focus.
Fitz gave a barely perceptible nod of his head. I didn't lead them here. They caught me while I was trying to recover the weapons. They forced me to come with them.
That's not what the priest said,
Aristides shot back. The father thought he was helping me, Fitz replied. There was no reason to hurt him.
No reason?
Aristides asked. His voice was dangerous, deadly, and smooth.
That he should trespass here is reason enough. But he wanted to destroy this family. That is something I will not permit.
Family, right, Fitz said. We're like the Simpsons around here. Personally, I would have gone with the Waltons, but I like the cut of the kid's jib. Aristides stared at Fitz with reptilian eyes and said,
Give me one reason why I should not kill you here and now.
Because you can't, Fitz said in a bored tone. You aren't going anywhere under your own power. You're fucked. You need help. The sorcerer's voice dropped to a bare whisper.
Do I?
Yep, Fitz said. Wasn't like it wasn't going to happen eventually anyway, right? Sooner or later, you were going to wind up eating applesauce with a rubber spoon somewhere. You think a bunch of kids you terrified into following you are going to take care of Grandpa Aristides? Come on.
I'll give you one chance, Aristides said. Leave. Now.
Fitz tapped a finger on his chin thoughtfully. Then he said,
Nah, don't think so.
Aristides blinked.
What?
Here's how it's going to work, Fitz said. I'm going to take the priest, those two guys, and the crew away from you. I'm going to get them some help. I'm going to call an ambulance and get you some help, too. After that, we never cross paths again.
Are you insane?
I was, Fitz said, nodding. I think I'm coming out of it now. I know you aren't coming back from Loopy Land, though, so I'm taking the crew away from you. Aristides clenched his fists and his eyes blazed, and though he probably didn't realize it, his concentration faltered. The influence magic he held over the children wavered.
Kill him.
The flat-eyed children looked at Fitz. Zero started taking a step toward him. Fitz's voice was a whip crack, sharp and loud in the echoing chamber. Stop! And they did. No magic was involved. Fitz had something more powerful than that. He'd cared for those other kids. He'd thought about them, encouraged them, and led them. That was something every bit as real as mystic power and dark enchantment, and it carries a hell of a lot more weight. Love always does. Zero, Fitz said quietly. We're done staying with this idiot. Put down the knife and come with me.
Zero,
Aristides said sharply.
I could all but see the strain in the air as the sorcerer doubled down on his influence working, struggling to force the boy to do his will. He shouldn't have bothered. It was over. It had been over ever since Fitz chose to walk back into that room. Fitz walked over to Zero and put a hand on the other boy's shoulder. Z, he said quietly, I can't make you do anything, so you tell me. Who do you want looking out for you, me or him? Zero looked searchingly at Fitz, then at Aristides.
Don't listen to him,
Aristides said through clenched teeth, spraying spittle.
Without me, you won't last a day on these streets. The Fomor will take you all.
No, Z, Fitz said quietly. They won't. It's okay. We've got help. Zero blinked his eyes several times. He bowed his head. The old knife in his fingers clattered to the concrete floor. Another dozen knives and pipes fell to the floor as the other boys released them. They all went over to Fitz and gathered around him.
I'll kill you,
hissed Aristides.
I'll kill you!
Fitz faced the crippled sorcerer and shook his head. Then he did what was possibly the cruelest thing he could have done to his former mentor. He turned away and ignored him. Zero, Fitz said. We need an ambulance for the father now. Call 911. Don't move him. Let the ambulance guys do that. Zero nodded and pulled one of those cheap prepaid cell phones out of the pocket of his oversized jacket. He ran for the door, presumably to get a better signal. Within the next few minutes, rough but serviceable medical supplies had been brought out, and Daniel's wounds had been cleaned and bound tighter than he'd been able to manage on his own. Aristides tried to get a couple of the kids to pay attention to him, but they were following Fitz's lead. They ignored him, so the sorcerer just sat and watched it all in stunned silence. Maybe I should have felt a little bit bad for the guy. As far as his world was concerned, he had just died. Only he was still alive to see the unthinkable, a world that existed without him. He was a living, breathing ghost. Maybe I should have felt some empathy there. But I really didn't. Butters stirred and sat up groggily as Fitz finished up tying a second pressure bandage to Daniel's leg. Michael's son let out a short grunt of pain and then breathed deeply several times. He was still shaking and pale, but his eyes were steady. He met Fitz's gaze and said, Thank you. Fitz shook his head. I didn't do anything. You two were the ones who beat him. The father was the one who beat him. Daniel corrected him. He knew what would happen to him when he came here. He knew we'd come after him. Butters grunted and spoke without opening his eyes.
Fort Hill wouldn't have played it like that. He came here to give peace a chance.
He groaned and pressed a hand to his jaw.
Ow.
Daniel frowned, thinking it over. So, he didn't want us to come after him? Butters snorted.
He knew we would come after him, no matter what he did. And he also knew that if the sorcerer went off on him, there would be someone to come along and do it the other way. He's a man of peace. Doesn't mean he's stupid.
Where is he? Daniel asked. By the fire, Fitz said. That way about 30 yards. The ambulance is on the way. Butters groaned and slowly pushed himself up. He rubbed at his jaw again and said,
Take me to him.
Wait, Daniel said. Fitz, you ran. I don't blame you, but you came back. Fitz paused, pursed his lips, and said, Yeah, I did, didn't I?
Why?
Fitz shrugged. Dresden. He told me that if I ran now, I'd run forever. And I'm sick of that.
Heh,
Butters said.
He totally Kenobi'd the day.
Dark eyes gleaming, he looked at Daniel.
Still have doubts?
Daniel shook his head once, smiling. Then he sank down to the floor with a satisfied groan.
The father, please, Butters said.
Fitz nodded and led Butters over toward the gang's little camp. But not before Butters looked around and said,
Thanks, Harry. Good to know you've still got our backs.
I watched them go to help Fort Hill quietly.
"Sure, man," I said, though I knew no one could hear me. "Anytime." Emergency service personnel arrived. By the time they got there, weapons had been hidden, stories had been set. Concerned adults had come to discourage some local homeless youth from playing and living in a dangerous old ruined building. There had been an altercation with a possibly drunken vagrant that had gotten out of hand. Things had fallen down, injuring several. It wouldn't have taken more than half a brain to see the holes in the story, but Butters knew the med techs. No one had been killed, and no one wanted to press any charges. The techs were willing to keep their mouths shut for a couple of greenbacks. Ah, Chicago. Fort Hill was in bad shape, but by the time they'd gotten him onto a stretcher and out to the ambulance, the Angel of Death was nowhere to be seen. Ha! Up yours, Reaper girl. The father would live to not fight another day. Daniel went with the father. Aristides rode in his own ambulance. He was still stunned by what had happened, or else smart enough to look disoriented and keep his mouth shut. The Tex, after a few quiet words from Butters, strapped his arms and legs down for the ride. He never resisted. He never did anything. The doors of the ambulance shut on the broken man. As for me, I couldn't emerge from the old factory into the light. I had to stay in shadowed doorways to watch the proceedings. The afternoon must have been a warm one. The snow had visibly begun to lessen, and water ran and dripped everywhere. When everyone with immediate medical needs had been taken care of, I went back to where I knew Butters would be. Sure enough, he came into the business entryway to recover his duffel bag and the flashlight containing Bob's skull. Butters slung the bag strap over his shoulder and pulled the little spirit radio out of it. He dropped that in his pocket and took out the flashlight housing. Then he held it up and said, "Okay, job's done." Orange campfire lights shot in a stream over my right shoulder and passed me into the eye sockets of the skull, where they took up their familiar glow.
"See? I told you so." "Duly noted," Butters said seriously.
I blinked at him and looked behind me, then back at the skull.
"Bob! You were behind me that whole time?" "Yeah," Bob said. "The nerd had me shadow you. Sorry, Harry."
Butters could see me, and I folded my arms and scowled at him. "You didn't trust me." Butters pushed his glasses up on his nose.
"Trust, but verify," he said seriously. "Don't take this the wrong way, Harry, but the testimony of a cat and a maybe insane girl, wizard or not, didn't exactly thrill all of us with its undeniable veracity."
"Murphy told you to do it," I said.
"Actually, Murphy didn't want any of us to take any chances dealing with you," he replied. "Things have used your appearance to get to her before."
I wanted to say something heated and ferocious, but all I could have rationally responded with was something like, "You're right." And that wouldn't have sounded very rational, so I just grunted. Butters nodded.
"And you've got to understand how bad the streets have been. The Fomor have no limits, Harry. They'll use women, children, pets, anything, to get an emotional lever on you, if they can. To fight that, you've got to have buckets and buckets of sang-froid."
I grunted and scowled some more. "But you bucked her orders." Butters scratched his nose with one finger.
"Well, you know, it sounds cooler if I say I acted on my own initiative. I had a hunch."
"Listen to Quincy here," the skull burbled, giggling.
"You had me, you dope." "I had you," Butters admitted, "and I trust you."
"And Murphy doesn't much," Bob said with cheery pride, "which is probably smart. Someone else gets hold of my skull, and who knows what they do with me. I'm a loose cannon. The wardens would waste me in a hot second."
"Present company excluded," I said.
"You don't count," the skull said stoutly. "You were drafted."
"Granted."
"The point being that I'm an outlaw. Then chicks love that."
"Aye," Butters said, rolling his eyes. "Enough, Bob." "You got it, hombre," Bob said.
I couldn't help laughing a little.
You see what I've got to live with, Butters said.
Yeah, I said.
He said. He rubbed at the back of his head. You're missed here, Harry, a lot. After a while, most of us, you know, we figured you were gone. We kind of had a wake at your grave. Pizza and beer, called it a funeral, but Murphy wouldn't go.
Illegal gathering, I said. Butters snorted out a breath through his nose.
That was your excuse, yeah.
Well, I said, we'll see. Butters paused, body motionless for a second.
We'll see what?
Whether or not this is permanent, I said, gesturing at myself. Butters snapped up straight.
What?
Bob thinks that there is hinkiness afoot with regard to my, disposition.
You could come back?
Butters whispered. Or maybe I haven't left, I said. I don't know, man. I got suckered into this whole encore appearance thing. I'm as in the dark as everyone else.
Wow,
Butters breathed. I waved a hand. Look, that will fall out where it may, I said. We've got a real problem to deal with, like right now. He nodded, one sharp gesture.
Tell me.
I told him about the corpse taker and her plan for Mort, and her deal with the point guy of the Fomor servitors. So we've got to break that up right the hell now, I concluded. I want you to get Murphy and her Vikings and tell them to go stomp the corpse taker's hideout. Butters sucked in a breath through his teeth.
Ugh, I know there hasn't been time for a lot of chit-chat since you, became departed, but they aren't Murphy's Vikings.
Whose are they?
Marcone's.
Oh.
We'll have to talk to Childs.
Marcone's new guy?
Yeah, him. Butters shivered. Guy gives me the creeps.
Could be Will and Company would be enough. Butters shook his head.
Could be Will and Company have done too much already, man. Seriously.
Something's got to happen. If you wait, you get a renegade wizard the White Council has nightmares about knocking on your front door. And by knocking, I mean converting it from matter to energy. Butters nodded.
I'll talk to her. We'll figure out something.
He squinted at me.
What are you going to be doing?
Covering the ghosty side of things, I said. She and her wannabe Bob and her lemurs and all the wraiths she's been calling up. Assuming things go well on the mortal coil, I don't want her slipping out the back door and coming back to haunt us another day. He frowned.
You're going to do that all by yourself?
I showed him my teeth.
Not exactly.
Move. There's not much time.
When?
He asked. When else? I answered. Sundown.
Chapter 40. I vanished from inside the factory the second I felt sundown shudder through reality. The jumps were longer now, almost double what I'd managed the night before, and it took less time to orient myself between them. I guess practice makes perfect, even if you're dead, or whatever I was. It took me less than 2 minutes to get to the burnt remains of Morty's place. On the way, I could see that southern winds were blowing, and they must have brought a springtime warmth with them. All of the city's snow was melting, and the combination of the two, with the oncoming night, meant that a misty fog hung in the air, cutting visibility down to maybe 50 or 60 feet. Fog in Chicago isn't terribly unusual, but never that thick. Streetlights were ringed with blurred, luminous halos. Traffic signals were soft blurs of changing color. Cars moved slowly, cautiously, and the thick mist laid a rare hush over the city, strangling its usual voice. I stopped about 100 yards away from Morty's house. There I felt it, a trace of the summoning energy that had been built into his former home, drawing me forward with the same gentle beckoning as might the scent of a hot meal after a long day. It was like the corpse taker's summons, but of a magic far less coarse, far more gentle. The necromancer's magic was like the suction of a vacuum cleaner. Mort's magic had been more like the gravity of the earth, less overtly powerful, but utterly pervasive. Hell, Mort's magic had probably had some kind of effect on me all the way over in Chicago between. His house was the first place I'd come to, after all, and though I had a logical reason to go there,
It was entirely possible that my reasoning had been influenced. It was magic, after all, intended to attract the attention of dangerous spirits. At that very moment, in her moldy old lair, the corpse-taker was torturing Morty and planning to murder my friends. So the remnants of the spell were definitely getting my attention. I went closer to Morty's house and felt that same pull get a little stronger. The spell had been broken when Mort's house had burned down, and it was fading. The morning sunrise had almost wiped it away. It wouldn't survive another dawn, but with a little help, it might serve its purpose one more time. From the voluminous pocket of my duster, I withdrew Sir Stuart's pistol. I fiddled with the gun until the gleaming silver sphere of the bullet rolled out into my hand, along with a sparkling cloud of flickering light. As each mote touched my skin, I heard the faint echo of a shot cracking out, the gunfire of Sir Stuart's memory. Hundreds of shots crackled in my ears, distant and faint, the ghostly memory equivalent of gunpowder. Sir Stuart had heard a lot of it. But what I needed wasn't firepower, not for this. I took up the shining silver sphere, the memory of Sir Stuart's home and family, and regarded it with my full attention. Once again, the scene of the small family farm seemed to swell in my vision until it surrounded me in a faint translucent landscape that quivered and throbbed with power all its own. For a second, I could hear the wind rustling through the fields of grain and smell the sharp, honest scents of animals drifting to me from the barn, mixing with the aroma of fresh-baked bread coming from the house. The shouts and cries of children playing some sort of game hung in the air. They weren't my memories, but I felt something beneath their surface, something powerful and achingly familiar. I reached into my own thoughts and produced the memories of my own home, casting them up to merge with Sir Stuart's cherished vision. I remembered the smell of wood and ink and paper, of all the shelves of second-hand books that had lined the walls of my old apartment with their ramshackle, double and triple-stacked layers of paperbacks. I remembered the scent of wood smoke in my fireplace, blending with the aroma of fresh coffee in a cup. I threw in a taste of Campbell's chicken soup in a steaming mug on a cold day when my clothes had been soaked with rain and snow and I had gotten out of them and huddled beneath a blanket near the fire, sipping soup and feeling the warmth sink into me. I remembered the solid warmth of my dog, Mouse, his heavy head pillowed on my leg while I read a book, and the softness of Mister's fur as he came by and gently batted my book away with his paw until I paused to give him his due share of attention. I remembered my apprentice, Molly, diligently studying and reading, remembered us having hours and hours of conversation as I taught her the basics of magic, of how to use it responsibly and wisely, or at least as responsibly and wisely as I knew how. They weren't necessarily the same thing. I remembered the feeling of pulling warm covers up over me as I went to bed, of listening to thunderstorms, complete with flickering lightning, pounding rain, and howling wind, and of the simple, secure pleasure of knowing that I was safe and warm while the elements raged outside. I remembered walking with confidence in pitch darkness because I knew every step that would take me safely through my rooms. Home. I invoked the memory of home. I don't know at what point the bullet dissolved into raw potential, but its power blended with my memories, humming a powerful harmonic chord with the emotions behind those memories, emotions common to all of us, a need for a place that is our own, security, safety, comfort. Home. Home, I breathed aloud. I found the tatters of Mort's gathering spell, and in my thoughts began to knit the edges of the memories together with the frayed magic. Home, I breathed again, gathering my will, fusing it with memory, and sending it out into the nighttime air. Come home, I said, and my voice carried into the night, reverberating through the mist, borne by the energy of my spell into a night shivering, encompassing music as I released that power and memory into the night. Come
home. Come home. It all flowed out of me in a steady, deliberate rush, leaving me with unhurried purpose. I felt the magic rush out in a steadily growing circle, and then it was gone, except for the faintest whisper of an echo. Come home. Come home. Come home. I opened my eyes slowly. There had been no sound, no stirring of energies, no warning of any kind. I stood in a circle of silent, staring, hollow-eyed spirits. Now that I knew what they were, the insane, dangerous ghosts of Chicago, the ones that killed people, they looked different. Those two little kids, my goodness, spooky now, a little too much darkness in their sunken eyes, expressions that wouldn't change if they were watching a car go by or pushing a toddler's head under the surface of the water. A businessman, apparently from the 19th century, I recognized as the shade of Herman Webster Mudgett, an American trailblazer in the field of entrepreneurial serial murder. I spotted another shade from a century earlier who could only have been Captain William Wells, a cold and palpable fury radiating from him still. There were more, many more. Chicago has an intense history of violence, tragedy, and sheer weirdness that really can't be topped this side of the Atlantic. I couldn't put names to a third of them, but I knew now, looking at them, exactly what they were. Lives that had ended in misery, in fury, in pain, or in madness. They were pure energy of destruction given human form, smoldering like coals that could still sear flesh long after they ceased to give off light. They were a loaded gun. Standing behind them, patient and calm, like sheepdogs around their flock, were the guardian spirits of Mort's house. I had assumed them to be his spiritual soldiers, but I could see now what their main purpose had been. They, the ghosts of duty and obligation, unfulfilled, had remained behind in an attempt to see their tasks to completion. They, the shades of faith, of love, of duty, had been a balancing energy with the dark power of the violent spirits. They had grounded the savagery and madness with their sheer, steady, simple existence, and the faded shade of Sir Stuart stood tall and calm among them. I held Sir Stuart's weapon in my right hand, and half wished I could go back in time and rap my 24 hours younger self on the head with it. The fading spirit hadn't been trying to hand me a weapon at all. He'd been giving me something far more dangerous than that. I thought he'd handed me potent but limited power, a single deadly shot. I'd been thinking in mortal terms from a mortal perspective. Stuart hadn't given me a gun. He'd given me a symbol. He'd given me authority. I held the gun in my right hand and closed my eyes for a moment, focusing on it, concentrating on not merely holding it, but taking it into me, making it my own. I opened my eyes, looked at the tall, brawny shade, and said, "Thank you, Sir Stuart." As I spoke, the gun shifted and changed, elongating abruptly. The wood of its grip and stock swelled out, becoming knife-planed oak, and as it did, I reached into my memory. Runes and sigils carved themselves in a tight spiral down the length of the staff. I took a deep breath and once more felt the solid power of my wizard's staff, 6 feet of oak as big around as my own circled thumb and finger, the foremost symbol of my power, gripped steadily in my hand. I bowed my head, focusing intently, drawing on the memories of the hundreds of spells and dozens of conflicts of my life, and as I did, the symbols on the staff pulsed with opalescent energy that reminded me of Sir Stuart's bullets in flight. Power hummed through the spectral wood, so that it shook in my hand and flickered sharply, sending pulses of weirdly colored light, light I sensed would be visible even to mortal eyes, surging through the mist.
There was a rushing sound, something almost like a sudden strike upon an unimaginably large and deep drum, an impact that rippled out from me and passed throughout the city and the surrounding lands. It sent a shiver of energy through me, and for an instant I felt the warmth of the southern wind, the close, muggy dampness of the air, the wet, slushy cold of the snow beneath my insubstantial